If you think this is an exaggeration, it's only a little while ago that I again ran into some workers, some welfare workers, Quakers, and Red Cross people who had been up in the Black Hills of Dakota some 5 or 6 weeks after this broadcast, persuading the people to leave the mountains and go back home because the Martians really hadn't come. All kinds of people reacted in all kinds of ways. For example, John Barrymore, the very famous American actor, this I know to be true, was listening to the broadcast and, although he was a friend of mine, ceased to identify me with the show and believed implicitly that America had fallen to the Martians. And hearing this on his radio, rushed out into his backyard where he kept 10 Great Danes in a kennels and released the dogs, giving them their freedom, crying to them as they ran in all directions of the compass, "The world has fallen, fend for yourselves." And I still meet people all over the place, everywhere in the world, who've had experiences, bitter or otherwise, as a result of our little experiment in broadcasting. Just the other day, I was coming here to England on the ferry, and some people were in the next compartment on the boat. The boat train said to me, "There you are, Orson. Well, you sure scared us. We were on our honeymoon, my wife and I." Sorry to say that they looked very ancient couple, but there they were. I said, "We were on our honeymoon and had a little portable radio. We were out there by the lake and heard what you said. We come right back home. That spoiled the honeymoon, but glad to see yours." And that kind of thing has followed me all over the world since then. And a lot of people wanted to know what to do. As a matter of fact, they were phoning us from all over the place, some of them reporting that they'd seen Martians landing in their backyards and asking for advice. And there were others that claimed to have been attacked personally by Martians. The whole experience was extremely intense. I suppose we had it coming to us because, in fact, we weren't as innocent as we meant to be when we did the Martian broadcast. We were fed up with the way in which everything that came over this new magic box, the radio, was being swallowed. People, you know, do suspect what they read in the newspapers and what people tell them, but when the radio came, and I suppose now television, anything that came through that new machine was believed. So in a way, our broadcast was an assault on the credibility of that machine. We wanted people to understand that they shouldn't take any opinion predigested, and they shouldn't swallow everything that came through the tap, whether it was radio or not.
Hello, and welcome to a special Halloween edition of the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me is my pal, Max Romero. Hi, Max.
Greetings from Grover's Mill, New Jersey, Rob.
Good evening. I'm Orson Welles. That's a terrible Orson Welles I just did. This episode, we're bringing back the Film and Water Podcast again for this special Halloween edition. This is airing on Halloween, October 31st, 2018. Of course, we've been doing all month a crossover of the Dark Podcast of Forbidden Love theme through all the various shows. Max, you did one on Plasticast, mm-hmm. and we did one on Digestcast, and whatever that name of Siskoid show is, I can never remember. And this one sort of fits in that it does feature a forbidden romance, and that's between man and Martian. That's the connective tissue here. We're here to present, in its entirety, Orson Welles' original 1938 broadcast of H.G. Welles's, a lot of Welles's, War of the Worlds, which is celebrating its 80th anniversary this year. In fact, just yesterday, October 30th, 1938, was when it aired on CBS Radio. Hey, my employers, CBS Radio, and it caused a stir and became one of like the touch points of pop culture and social sort of upheaval of the time. And so we're going to get into the details of it. But Max, I want to ask you, when did you become familiar with the War of the Worlds radio broadcast as a thing in the history?
Wow. Okay. Well, first of all, let me get one thing out of the way. War of the Worlds is my favorite science fiction story, period. Number one, no questions asked. this is it. So,
all right.
You know, I'm going to, as you say, I'm going to wax this car until it shines. The my first introduction to War of the Worlds was actually the George Pal 1953 movie. But after that, I was hooked. And I want to say that I first heard it probably in the classroom, actually, because I went to an elementary school where for Halloween, they would often put us into the library and they would play, you know, records. They would play audio dramas for us.
Wow,
yeah.
That's cool.
And yeah, the first one I heard was the Telltale Heart, which scared the hell out of me. but I also remember listening to this broadcast, and I was listening to it again in preparation for this episode. And, you know, it still gives me goosebumps. It's just a fantastically put together radio drama. And even knowing everything behind it and all the history, it still works exceptionally well.
Yeah, it really doesn't age. You know, I don't remember the first I ever heard of it. It's at some point during, I think, the 50s, it fell out of copyright. And so that meant anybody that could had a recording of it could issue it. So you can find War of the Worlds in so many versions. And I had a record at some point of it. And because, again, like you, I read the War of the Worlds book, mm-hmm. Which is true. It's a classic, of course. Everybody knows that by now. And I saw the movie, the George Pal movie, which, again, is also a classic. And we're going to talk about the George Pal movie briefly. But at some point, I want to devote a whole episode of the Film and Water podcast to that movie because it's so great.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, well, I always love War of the Worlds. And so I don't, again, at some point I knew about Orson Welles. I was, oh, that wine guy, you know, whatever. And then it was like, he did this thing that scared the hell out of people. Like, what? And then I heard it and I remember just thinking, yeah, it really is very blunt and straightforward. The fact that it sounds like a real radio broadcast. It's reality radio, you know, mm-hmm. Reality TV is given that it's a bad name nowadays, but it was reality radio. And that if you stumbled upon this thing and not knowing the context, you would be a little freaked out. And that's exactly, of course, what happened. Now, legend has it that the freak out wasn't quite as big as the, you know, the story has gone on,
right.
But it's still nevertheless. And we do know that while the show was actually occurring during the last like quarter, they were getting phone calls at the station of people freaking out and wondering what's happening, where is all this happening, all this stuff. I mean, it really did a number on people. And you have to imagine this is where America was in 1938. It was on the cusp of a world war. Mm-hmm. People were probably a little anxious. Thank God we're past that nowadays. And so
yeah, things like that don't happen anymore.
Things like that don't happen anymore. So people were kind of just, you know, they were worried about, they were uncertain about where the world was heading in a lot of ways. And here, all of a sudden, we're hearing about Martians landing. I don't know. I mean, it's easy for us to look back at these people now and like kind of scoff and be like, what are you people stupid? You can't figure this out. But I don't know. I mean, a lot of people fall for a lot of dumb shit nowadays. So I don't think we'd really be any better off nowadays.
Well, you know, and you know, I think like a lot of things, you have to think about it in context. You know, people, a lot of the science that we take for granted now, well, some of us take for granted now, is so it seems silly now when you hear the radio play or you read the book or, you know, you think, oh, microbes. And yeah, great. You know, they think there's an atmosphere on Mars, all these things. But people didn't know back then. This was still a very young, you know, area of study in a lot of ways. So it was for people listening to the radio and people who might not have, you know, access to the information that we have now, but it's completely credible.
Yeah, it reminds me of a book I read many years ago about FDR's all the different programs that he was, you know, putting through in the 30s and the 40s to get the country out of the Depression. And one of the programs, and I forget the name of it, but it was involving getting books to rural parts of the country that were separated from cities because, of course, this was before the interstate highway system. So there were lots of parts of rural America that were very, very cut off. And so they would literally hire teachers and other educators to get in cars or, in some cases, bikes or even horses.
Wow.
With sacks of books. And they just brought these books to people. And I remember at the time I read the book, there were interviews with some of the teachers. Like, this book was written long enough ago that some of these people were still around. And there was one woman who said she remembered visiting a bunch of rural people who literally did not know how to read. They had never seen a book. That's how cut off from the world they were. And so now, obviously, if you don't have a, if you don't have access to a book, you probably don't have radio.
Right.
But nevertheless, that's how cut off a lot of people were. And I mean, I don't mean to suggest it was just people in rural counties that were having – people in cities were freaking out too.
Yeah.
But like you said, we weren't – people didn't – a lot of this stuff was new.
Right.
This science. I mean, obviously, in 1938, we hadn't – you know, we didn't have a space program or anything like that. Nobody knew about this stuff. So it seemed – plausible. Now, part of it is Wells picked a perfect source material to adapt because, I mean, one of the things that makes the original H.G. Wells novel from 1898 so memorable is that it's pretty brutal. If you haven't read it, it's for a novel written by a proper English gentleman in the late 19th century, it gets pretty gruesome about how. In the detail it gets into how the Martian rays just immolate people and turn their bones into dust. And apparently it was fairly controversial at the time that it was as kind of as gory as it was. And so here you've got Orson Welles using this new technology. Again, radio still relatively new. Adapting, yes, a book that was already 40 years old, but it was kind of a barn burner of a book at the time. I mean, he wasn't taking something gentle. He was taking something kind of rough and then making it seem even the more real. So he knew exactly the right thing to kind of adapt to scare people.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because, you know, that's one of the things that I like so much about – I don't know what this is about me, but this is one of the things I like so much about War of the Worlds is just how bleak it is. You know, it is a total downer if you think about
yep.
it. Because like you said, you know, it's – essentially, it's people being helpless. It's humanity
yep.
being at the complete mercy of something that they don't even understand.
Yep.
And, you know, everyone goes about, oh, yeah, they got sick at the end and they just died. You know, how lame is that? But to me, that kind of emphasizes how insignificant people are supposed to be in this story.
Yes. Yep.
Because it really... the only reason humanity survives is by dumb chance.
It's right. Yep.
Complete
yep.
luck. It has nothing to do with anything humanity has done. Otherwise, you know, these tripods would still be marching across the world, vaporizing people and harvesting them for their blood and making red vines and you know, everything else. And the radio broadcast does such a great job of ratcheting up that tension. Because when it starts out, you know, Orson Welles is the main character. He's the professor who's kind of giving out, you know, he's telling the listeners what's happening. And he starts out very arrogant, very much what you would think of as a college professor. You know, I know everything. There's nothing to worry about. I doubt that that's happening. And as it goes on, he has to admit he has no idea what's happening and he has no idea what people should do. And if you think about it, that is frightening because we look to our educators and our professors and our leaders to give us guidance. And if one day they just say, I don't know, you know, that puts people into a panic. And I think that's one of the genius things about this radio adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, the Martians don't ever give any speeches about what they want.
No.
They're just implacable. I mean, these creatures just show up and just start killing everybody. That's it.
Yep.
There's no true scene. There's no scene of like, let's talk to the Martians and figure out what they want. No, these invaders just start coming and killing everybody randomly, and then they are killed just as randomly.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. The one time
they try to communicate with them with the white flag, they get vaporized.
Yeah. Yeah. Screw that. So, okay, yeah. And that is one of the greatest hooks of the thing. And there's a moment in the movie, in the 1953 movie, where the main character, Gene, played by Gene Barry, plays the scientist. And he's got this moment where he is watching what's happening. And, of course, you know, everyone's turning – like you just talked about. Everyone's turning to him for explanations. And he doesn't know.
Right.
Because how could he know? And there's a part where he watches something happen. I forget exactly what it is. But he sees something and he just goes, this is amazing. And
yeah.
It's like even the scientist is like, wow, I can't believe I'm looking at this. And that's – even though you – It's charming in its own way, but it's also kind of scary because I don't want the guy who's in charge to not be understanding what's happening. You know,
right.
Like, that's
it's
not
horrifying.
A good thing, so.
It's very Lovecraftian before Lovecraft.
Right.
you know.
Plus, it doesn't have all that, you know, he doesn't have all of Lovecraft's.
Yeah, it doesn't have all that
particular peccadilloes involved. Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately. Exactly.
Oh no, a Jewish person, run! You know, he doesn't have any of that.
Exactly.
So, yeah. What did you think of the Tom Cruise Steven Spielberg version from 2005?
You know, I get a lot of crap for this from my wife, who hates Tom Cruise. but I actually really enjoy that movie. For completely different reasons. The George Powell movie is very much of its time, but it also has some iconic imagery. But what I like about the Tom Cruise one is that, for me, it hews much closer to the actual book. And it in itself is also very bleak. People make fun of Tom Cruise running all the time, but he spends this movie doing nothing but running. He's just running. Mm-hmm. Trying to save his life, trying to save the life of his kids, of his daughter, what's his name?
Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins is one of the scariest things in that movie.
He's weird. He's a real weirdo in that one.
Yeah, and what happens in that scene between him and Tom Cruise at the end is horrifying, and it's horrifying in itself just because that is an indicator of the depths people would go to. In a crisis situation like that, where there is no hope, and I really want really enjoy it. I think it's really rewatchable, and I enjoy how closely it aligns itself with the original story in the book.
Yeah, and I would agree tonally. It does match up with the book, and of course it's Spielberg's kind of 9/11, you know, analogy of watching the systems that we've built for ourselves collapse under the weight of some immense catastrophe. Mm-hmm. Like that. And so, yeah, I liked it. I liked it at the time. I haven't seen it in a very long time. I like the fact that the two stars of the original version make a cameo in it.
Yeah.
I think that's like really cute. I remember thinking it was pretty good. I probably would like to revisit it because, again, I love War of the Worlds. I have a vinyl LP like audio drama, not the Orson Welles one, a different one, adaptation of it with a Wally Wood cover.
Oh, wow.
Which is really, it was part of a whole series of adaptations of like sort of fantasy fiction done as Power Records before there were Power Records. And all the covers are by Wally Wood. So it's like First Man on the Moon, War of the Worlds, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Oh, wow.
They're really fun. And just the sleeve art is so beautiful because it's like it's Wally Wood drawing with all the machinery and all the great stuff that he used to do. So,
right.
And in terms of Orson Welles, I do want to give a little bit of context as to where he was here. Orson Welles was the major, the ringmaster of the Mercury Theater, which was this troupe of actors that he had, and they put on different every week they would do some sort of different show. They would do a dramatic presentation, and it came out of Orson Welles' work for the WPA when they were putting on plays. They were bringing theater to people, to the masses. And he was doing all sorts of very strange productions and things that nobody had ever seen before. He did a version of Macbeth with an all African-American cast.
Oh, wow.
that was shown only in sort of like predominantly African-American neighborhoods. And he used like filmed pieces in it. Like it was a real audiovisual presentation. And of course, there's no video footage of any of this stuff, unfortunately. Mm. But from the people that saw the stuff, they said it was amazing. So eventually moved on to radio, and he became a sensation. Now, I love Orson Welles unconditionally. I just do. He was one of the first sort of directors whose work I hooked into at a young age, and I just – I mean, obviously the linchpin of it is Citizen Kane. Mm. But he's done a lot of other great stuff too, and – there was something about him that he was this genius, but kind of an impish genius. He sort of kidded the audience and made them in on the joke about his own genius, sort of, which I really enjoyed. And so I hadn't had a chance really to listen to much of the Mercury Theater stuff, because again, this was as I was coming out, this is pre-internet, so there was no YouTube to hear any of this stuff.
Right.
But stuff would leak through. There would be like a cassette that would come out, and like, oh, here's some Mercury Theater broadcast. Then one year when I was working at Movies Unlimited, the video store that I worked at, they released a laser disc of Mercury Theater presentations. Now, you might say, why a laser disc? An audio-only laser disc? What is the point of that? You know, it's like porno in Braille or something. What was the point? But nevertheless, whoever did it, put it together, you know, cleaned up the originals and took out all the pops and hisses and all this stuff and put together like sort of a greatest hits collection. And it was called Theater of the Imagination. And so I bought it and I had a Laserdisc player back then. And I listened to it and I just fell in love with it because it was so charming and it would be like highbrow stuff and lowbrow stuff. They did a version of Dracula. There's one segment called Ladies and Gentlemen, There's a Full Moon Out Tonight, where Orson Welles is just talking about how when he looks outside the window of his building, he can see there's a full moon and what that does to people. And it was it felt like he just made it up on the spot. Like they were, you know, they one of them said, "Hey, Orson, well, let's talk about the full moon. All right, let's do it." It just had this real joie de vivre energy to it. And of course, all the people that he's working with are people you would later see in his movies, specifically Citizen Kane. And a bunch of the actors in this version of War of the Worlds appear in Citizen Kane. The studio announcer is Paul Stewart, who played Citizen Kane's butler. He's the one at the end who says, "I was in the room with him, Rosebud. Yeah, I heard it." The announcer is William Allen. William Allen is in Citizen Kane. He's the reporter who is trying to find out what Rosebud means. He's the guy whose face you'd never see.
Oh.
He's always shot from the back. And Mr. Wilmoth, one of the characters in Orson Welles, is Ray Collins, who plays boss Jim Geddes in Citizen Kane. So these are all people that Orson would just keep using from project to project. The War of the Worlds version was adapted by Howard Koch, who was a playwright and screenwriter. He worked on a little movie called Casablanca. And this idea that Welles had of making it sound like a real drama that was being interrupted by news reports, him and Koch just didn't come up with it out of nowhere. It was influenced by some Columbia Workshop presentation. There was one called The Fall of the City, which was a 1937 radio play where Welles played the role of an omniscient announcer, and another one called Air Raid, which was an As It Happens drama, starred again Ray Collins, that aired on October 27, 1938. And Welles himself had used a newscast format for a version of Julius Caesar, which aired on September 11th, 1938, with H.V. Kaltenbrunner providing historical commentary throughout the story.
Oh, wow.
So all these ideas were sort of percolating, and they all came together for this War of the Worlds presentation. And one last thing I want to mention about specifically Welles and his career. I love this story. I might have even told it on a previous episode, but Welles was in such demand as a radio act. Of course, he played The Shadow. A bunch of shows, and he would have to rocket across town because, of course, radio was done live back then.
Right.
And he would have to get across town at a moment's notice. He actually hired an ambulance to cart him around so it could cut through traffic. And supposedly it was and eventually somebody in authority was like, "You can't do that. You have to. If it's an ambulance, it has to be a real ambulance." And apparently but there was no law against it. There was no law in the books, and it was apparently after that they wrote the law that said you can't use an ambulance for anything other than transporting sick people around. But you know, Welles just had that kind of like, you know, I think he lived by the credo of better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Right.
You know, he just went ahead and did this stuff, and he got in trouble, for War of the Worlds. But then he kind of just did his aw shucks. I didn't know this was going to happen. And, of course, later on, you know, he was – taken to task for scaring the crap out of America. And he was like, "Oh, we didn't know we were doing that," which is exactly what he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
He wanted to do it. That was the plan all along.
Yeah. People wanted to take it to the FCC and cops showed up at the studio on the night that they did it. And it was crazy, but I'm sure he was eating it up.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely. Loved it. And then one other little detail that I love is there on that Theater of the Imagination Laserdisc I told you about, there is an actual segment from an episode of the Mercury Theater where Orson Welles is interviewing H.G. Wells.
Mm-hmm.
H.G. Wells was an old man, and they met, and it was after Welles had finished Citizen Kane, but it had not yet been released. But H.G. Wells had seen it. And they ask H.G. Wells, "What do you think of this movie, Citizen Kane?" And he referred to it and said, "I think it has a lot of jolly new noises in it." I just love that phrase. It has a bunch of jolly new – because it sure did, H.G. It sure did. And apparently H.G. Wells loved this. He loved this version of it. He thought Wells did a terrific job on his book. So it was a kind of a mutual admiration society. But, I mean, I love that. I can't find it anymore. I haven't been able to find it on YouTube. But, man, I love that idea that of like – imagine having H.G. Wells and Orson Welles in the same room together. That's unbelievable.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was hoping to talk about that too. Yeah, apparently they met in 1940 in San Antonio. So it was only a couple of years after the broadcast.
Right, right.
And, you know, H.G. Wells was, he was very good-natured about it. He said, well, it's Halloween. You know, that sounds great. And he, you know, I think the quote is, are you sure there was such a panic in America, or was it your Halloween fun? And Orson Welles, you know, basically expanded on that and said, you know, yeah, it's like when someone puts a sheet over their head and says, boo. You don't think anyone actually believes that that person is a ghost, but we scream and we run away. And he said that's basically what happened with War of the Worlds.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine H.G. Wells must have been pretty thrilled to have a story that he wrote 40 years later get scare the hell out of people like that. And to this day, there is a plaque in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, which is only an hour from here. I have to go over there sometime and see this plaque. But there is a plaque commemorating the radio broadcast of where, and it's got a flying saucer on and stuff. Because, I mean, the Grover's Mill people, you know, I mean, he just plucked this town out of nowhere. And all of a sudden, that's the genius of it, is making the Martians land in a town that nobody's heard of. You know, they didn't land in Times Square. You know, everybody knows Times Square, but Grover's Mill, where's that? Is that even a real town? I mean, again, that's the genius of it. But I'm guessing that Grover's Mill has been dining out on this for 80 years. So I have got to get a picture of myself next to that plaque, because that's just too cool.
Well, it's interesting because apparently the original version of the script was too detailed. You know, it mentioned St. Patrick's Cathedral, and it mentioned, very specific places, and they had to kind of tone that down. But in a weird way, that kind of works, because it's still recognizable. You still know what they're talking about, but that ambiguity makes it almost like it could be anywhere. And it's like a good horror film from the 50s or this, you know, where you are essentially filling in the blanks yourself. And I think that just makes the horrific nature of it, the tension of it, even higher.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's it. Orson, he really knew how to kind of like let you lean in a little and start piecing it together yourself, which makes it all the more scary. And this thing, of course, had a huge pop culture reach. There have been multiple versions of it in different languages. There was apparently a version, a live recreation of the broadcast featuring host Glenn Beck. So that you can skip. there's one with like different people from Star Trek. They did a version with Leonard Nimoy, John DeLancey, Dwight Schultz, Will Wheaton, and Gates McFadden, Brent Spiner, and Armin Shimerman.
Mm-hmm.
It's called When Wells Collide, which is really fun. So there's if any of you have ever seen The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, there's a plot detail that hinges on the Martians landing in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, which is really fun. So this thing is when most old-time radio has been forgotten, to be honest. This thing still has this sort of pop culture reach, and I think it's because it's just so well done. So what we're going to do, Max and I are going to get out of the way here, and after a podcast promo break, we're going to play the entire show, because as I said, it's out of copyright. Thanks, everybody. And you know, because it's on YouTube, but I don't know about you, Max. Like, I find with YouTube, like, there's so much there that I don't listen to any of it, because I can't wade through. It's kind of like Netflix. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much stuff on Netflix I want to watch. I don't watch anything because I just can't decide. It's just too much. And so I thought it would be fun to just put this out on Halloween and play the entire show as it aired originally in 1938. So before we get onto it, is there anything else we want to say about War of the Worlds?
Well, the only thing I would like to mention too is that I think part of the reason – one of the things that I love most about the broadcast is the opening. Because it sets up so many things that again make that tension really come through. I love that there's a part where the radio announcer is speaking, you can hear a clock ticking behind them, mm-hmm. and it's just this really insistent tick, 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 tick. It's almost too loud, but it just really makes you go like, oh my god, what's going to happen? And the voices get more tense. The musical breaks. The dead air. When they go back to the reporter Carl Phillips, who's amazing, all of that really just it really lays the foundation for everything that's gonna. And that was Frank Reddick as Carl Phillips, who listened to the Hindenburg report over and over, apparently, to get that tone for his for his report. All of that sets up all the groundwork, I think, for what comes after. And I think that is just, you know, that kind of foresight into a radio drama to me is just really so impressive.
Yeah, it's an very impressive piece of work. And, you know, Orson Welles is having a moment right now because just a couple of days after this episode airs, there will be a new Orson Welles film out, which is I'm expecting to only be able to say that one time in my life. His final film, The Other Side of the Wind, is debuting on Netflix. It was a film that he started shooting before I was born. And never completed, really, to Welles' satisfaction due to various mishaps and things and that. But thanks to a lot of the people that Peter Bogdanovich and other people that have been sort of championing this thing for so long, and Netflix finally ponying up the money, the film has been completed, and it is going to debut just a couple days from now on Netflix. And I'm going to be there that night to watch Orson Welles' new/last film, because I've been hearing about this my whole life, this movie.
Yeah.
And it's just so exciting. I said, I hope at some point to devote episodes of the Film and Water podcast to Orson Welles' work. We've talked about Citizen Kane, but that's really about it. And he's a lot more than that. Not that you didn't need to be. It's, you know, right. If you only had Citizen Kane on your filmography, that's enough. But he did a lot of really interesting stuff, including, as we're going to hear it, this version of War of the Worlds. So enjoy this commercial announcement. And after that, you're going to hear the War of the Worlds. And everybody, happy Halloween.
Watch the skies.
By golly, it's amazing. It sounds like something you'd hear on the radio.
Greetings, I'm Kevin Lauderdale, and twice a month I bring you comedy, drama, adventure, mysteries, and quiz shows from the golden age of radio on my podcast, Presenting the Transcription Feature.
Presenting the Transcription Feature?
That's the one. Comedy from Jack Benny to Groucho Marx, mystery from Sherlock Holmes to Dragnet, quiz shows like Information Please, science fiction programming like X-1, all ranging from the 1930s to the 1950s, when the theater of the mind was king.
Dramatically, it was, I don't think there's any medium better.
And when the references are a little obscure...
Have you seen the shape of King Farouk? Can you imagine a cigarette built like him?
I provide a couple of cultural notes up front. So check out Presenting the Transcription Feature on the Chronic Rift Network. Subscribe on iTunes or visit chronicrift.com.
Good night, folks. Sign and all.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Welles. Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space. Yet across an immense ethereal gulf, minds that are to our minds as ours are to the beasts in the jungle, intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. In the 39th year of the 20th century came the Great Disillusionment. Near the end of October, business was better. The war scare was over. More men were back at work. Sales were picking up. On this particular evening, October 30th, the Crosley Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios.
For the next 24 hours, not much change in temperature. A slight atmospheric disturbance of undetermined origin is reported over Nova Scotia. causing a low-pressure area to move down rather rapidly over the northeastern states, bringing a forecast of rain accompanied by winds of light gale force. Maximum temperature 66, minimum 48. This weather report comes to you from the Government Weather Bureau. We take you now to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. From the Meridian Room in the Park Plaza Hotel in New York City, we bring you the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra. With a touch of the Spanish, Raymond Raquello leads off with La Campesita.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote. We now return you to the music of Raymond Raquello, playing for you in the Meridian Room of the Park Plaza Hotel, situated in downtown New York.
Tune that never loses favor. The ever-popular Stardust. Raymond Raquello and his orchestra.
Ladies and gentlemen, following on the news given in our bulletin a moment ago, the Government Meteorological Bureau has requested the large observatories of the country to keep an astronomical watch on any further disturbances occurring on the planet Mars. Due to the unusual nature of this occurrence, we have arranged an interview with a noted astronomer, Professor Pearson, who will give us his views on this event. In a few moments, we will take you to the Princeton Observatory at Princeton, New Jersey. We return you until then to the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra. Now to take you to the Princeton Observatory at Princeton, where Carl Phillips, our commentator, will interview Professor Richard Pearson, famous astronomer. We take you now to Princeton, New Jersey.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carl Phillips speaking to you from the observatory at Princeton. I'm standing in a large semicircular room, pitch black except for an oblong split in the ceiling. Through this opening, I can see a sprinkling of stars that cast a kind of frosty glow over the intricate mechanism of the huge telescope. Ticking sound you hear is the vibration of the clockwork. Professor Pearson stands directly above me on a small platform, peering through the giant lens. I'll ask you to be patient, ladies and gentlemen, during any delay that may arise during our interview. Besides the ceaseless watch of the heavens, Professor Pearson may be interrupted by telephone or other communications. During this period, he is in constant touch with the astronomical centers of the world. Professor, may I begin our questions?
Any time, Mr. Phillips.
Professor, would you please tell our radio audience exactly what you see as you observe the planet Mars through your telescope?
Nothing unusual at the moment, Mr. Phillips. A red disk swimming in a blue sea. Transverse stripes across the disk. Quite distinct now because Mars happens to be at the point nearest the Earth, in opposition, as we call it.
In your opinion, what do these transverse stripes signify, Professor Pearson?
Not canals, I can assure you, Mr. Phillips.
They
although that's the popular conjecture of those who imagine Mars to be inhabited. From a scientific viewpoint, the stripes are merely the result of atmospheric conditions peculiar to the planet.
Then you're quite convinced, as a scientist, that living intelligence as we know it does not exist on Mars?
I say the chances against it are 1,000 to 1.
And yet, how do you account for these gas eruptions occurring on the surface of the planet at regular intervals?
Phillips, I cannot account for it.
Oh, by the way, Professor, for the benefit of our listeners, how far is Mars from the Earth?
Approximately 40 million miles.
Well, that seems a safe enough distance.
Thank you.
Just a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Someone has just handed Professor Pearson a message. While he reads it, let me remind you that we are speaking to you from the observatory in Princeton, New Jersey, where we are interviewing the world-famous astronomer, Professor Pearson. One moment, please. Professor Pearson has passed me a message which he has just received. Professor, may I read the message to the listening audience?
Certainly, Mr. Phillips.
Ladies and gentlemen, I shall read you a wire addressed to Professor Pearson from Dr. Gray of the Natural History Museum, New York. Quote, 9:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Seismograph registered shock of almost earthquake intensity occurring within a radius of 20 miles of Princeton. Please investigate. Signed, Lloyd Gray, Chief of Astronomical Division. Unquote. Professor Pearson, could this occurrence possibly have something to do with the disturbances observed on the planet Mars?
Hardly, Mr. Phillips. This is probably a meteorite of unusual size, and its arrival at this particular time is merely a coincidence. However, we shall conduct a search as soon as daylight permits.
Thank you, Professor. Ladies and gentlemen, for the past 10 minutes, we've been speaking to you from the observatory at Princeton, bringing you a special interview with Professor Pearson, noted astronomer. This is Carl Phillips speaking. We are returning you now to our New York studio.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is the latest bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News, Toronto, Canada. Professor Morris of Macmillan University reports observing a total of 3 explosions on the planet Mars between the hours of 7:45 p.m. and 9:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This confirms earlier reports received from American observatories. Now, nearer home, comes a special bulletin from Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:50 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, 22 miles from Trenton. The flash in the sky was visible within a radius of several hundred miles, and the noise of the impact was heard as far north as Elizabeth. We have dispatched a special mobile unit to the scene, and we'll have our commentator, Carl Phillips, give you a word picture of the scene as soon as he can reach there from Princeton. In the meantime, we take you to the Hotel Martinet in Brooklyn, where Bobby Millett and his orchestra are offering a program of dance music. We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Professor Pearson and myself made the 11 miles from Princeton in 10 minutes. Well, I hardly know where to begin to paint for you a word picture of the strange scene before my eyes, but something out of a modern Arabian night. Well, I just got here. I haven't had a chance to look around yet. I guess that's it. Yes, I guess that's the thing directly in front of me, half buried in a vast pit. Must have struck with terrific force. The ground is covered with splinters of a tree. It must have struck on its way down. But I can see the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor, at least not the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. Has a diameter of, what would you say, Professor Pearson?
What's that?
What would you say? What's the diameter of this?
About 30 yards.
About 30 yards. The metal on the sheath is, well, I've never seen anything like it. The color is sort of yellowish white. It's curious. Spectators now are pressing close to the object in spite of the efforts of the police to keep them back. Getting in front of my line of vision. Would you mind standing one side, please? While the police are pushing the crowd back. Here's Mr. Wilmot, owner of the farm here. He may have some interesting facts to add. Mr. Wilmot, would you please tell the radio audience as much as you remember of this rather unusual visitor that dropped in your backyard? Step closer, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Wilmot.
Well, I was listening to the radio.
Closer and louder, please.
Pardon me?
Louder, please. Closer.
Yes.
I was listening to the radio and kind of drowsing. That professor fellow was talking about Mars, so I was half chosen and half...
Yes, yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then what happened?
Well, as I was saying, I was listening to the radio kind of halfway.
Yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then you saw something.
Well, not first off. I heard something.
And what did you hear?
A hissing sound like this. Kind of like a 4th of July rocket.
Yes, then what?
I turned my head out the window and would have sworn I was asleep and dreaming.
Yes?
I seen a kind of greenish streak and then zingo. Something smacked the ground, knocked me clear out of my chair.
Well, were you frightened, Mr. Wilmot?
Well, I ain't quite sure. I reckon I was kind of riled.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wilmot. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you want me to talk
No, that's quite all right. That's plenty. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard Mr. Wilmot, owner of the farm where this thing has fallen. I wish I could convey the atmosphere, the background of this fantastic scene. Hundreds of cars are parked in a field in back of us, and the police are trying to rope off the roadway leading into the farm, but it's no use. They're breaking right through. The car's headlights throw an enormous spotlight on the pit where the object's half buried. Now, some of the more daring souls now are venturing near the edge. The silhouettes stand out against the metal sheen. One man wants to touch the thing. He's having an argument with the policeman. Now, the policeman wins. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen, please. Do you hear it? It's a curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. I'll move the microphone nearer. Here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson.
Yes, Mr. Brooks.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
I don't know what to think. The metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial. Not found on this Earth. Friction with the Earth's atmosphere usually tears holes in a meteorite. This thing is smooth, and you can see its cylindrical
just a minute.
Shape.
Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and this thing must be hollow.
He's moving! Keep back there! Keep back there! Keep those men back! Keep back there! Keep those idiots back! Keep off! The top's loose!
Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's calling
someone
or something. I can see turning out of that black hole two luminous discs. The eyes, it might be a face, might be almost. But heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body now. It's large, and large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face, ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black, and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is a kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate, and the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. The thing's rising up now, and the crowd falls back. There seems plenty. The most extraordinary experience, ladies and gentlemen. I can't find words. Well, I'll pull this microphone with me as I talk. I'll have to stop the description until I can take a new position. Hold on, will you, please? I'll be right back in a minute.
We are bringing you an eyewitness account of what's happening on the Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmot's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means, Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. The whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks, and the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission. However, we will return to that point at the earliest opportunity. In the meantime, we have a late bulletin from San Diego, California. Professor Indelkoffer, speaking at a dinner of the California Astronomical Society, expressed the opinion that the explosions on Mars are undoubtedly nothing more than severe volcanic disturbances on the surface of the planet. We continue now with our piano interlude. Ladies and gentlemen, I've just been handed a message that came in from Grover's Mill by telephone. Just one moment, please. At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill. Their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition. The next voice you hear will be that of Brigadier General Montgomery Smith, commander of the state militia at Trenton, New Jersey.
I have been requested by the governor of New Jersey to place the counties of Mercer and Middlesex as far west as Princeton and east to Jamesburg under martial law. No one will be permitted to enter this area except by special pass issued by state or military authorities. 4 companies of state militia are proceeding from Trenton to Grover's Mill and will aid in the evacuation of homes within the range of military operations. Thank you.
You have just been listening to General Montgomery Smith, commanding the state militia at Trenton. In the meantime, further details of the catastrophe at Grover's Mill are coming in. The strange creatures, after unleashing their deadly assault, crawled back in their pit and made no attempt to prevent the efforts of the firemen to recover the bodies and extinguish the fire. The combined fire departments of Mercer County are fighting the flames which menace the entire countryside. We have been unable to establish any contact with our mobile unit at Grover's Mill, but we hope to be able to return you there at the earliest possible moment. In the meantime, we take you to... Just one moment, please. Ladies and gentlemen, I have just been informed that we have finally established communication with an eyewitness of the tragedy. Professor Pearson has been located at a farmhouse near Grover's Mill, where he has established an emergency observation post. As a scientist, he will give you his explanation of the calamity. The next voice you hear will be that of Professor Pearson, brought to you by direct wire. Professor Pearson.
Of the creatures in the rocket cylinder at Grover's Mill, I can give you no authoritative information, either as to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth. Of their destructive instrument, I might venture some conjectural explanation. For want of a better term, I shall refer to the mysterious weapon as a heat ray. It's all too evident that these creatures have scientific knowledge far in advance of our own. It's my guess that in some way they are able to generate an intense heat in a chamber of practically absolute non-conductivity. This intense heat they project in a parallel beam against any object they choose by means of a polished parabolic mirror of unknown composition, much as the mirror of a lighthouse projects a beam of light. That is my conjecture of the origin of the heat ray.
Thank you, Professor Pearson. Ladies and gentlemen, here is a bulletin from Trenton. It is a brief statement informing us that the charred body of Carl Phillips has been identified in a Trenton hospital. Now, here's another bulletin from Washington, D.C. The office of the director of the National Red Cross reports 10 units of Red Cross emergency workers have been assigned to the headquarters of the state militia, stationed outside of Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Here's a bulletin from State Police, Princeton Junction. The fires at Grover's Mill and vicinity are now under control. Scouts report all quiet in the pit, and there is no sign of life appearing from the mouth of the cylinder. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special statement from Mr. Harry McDonald, Vice President in charge of operations.
We have received a request from the state militia of Trenton to
to place at their disposal our entire broadcasting facilities. In view of the gravity of the situation, and believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times, we are turning over our facilities to the state militia at Trenton.
We take you now to the field headquarters of the state militia near Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
This is Captain Lansing of the Signal Corps, attached to the state militia, now engaged in military operations in the vicinity of Grover's Mill. Situation arising from the reported presence of certain individuals of unidentified nature is now under complete control. The cylindrical object, which lies in a pit directly below our position, surrounded on all sides by 8 battalions of infantry, without heavy field pieces, but adequately armed with rifles and machine guns. All cause for alarm, if such cause ever existed, is now entirely unjustified. Things, whatever they are, do not even venture to poke their heads above the pit. I can see their hiding place plainly in the glare of the searchlights here. With all their reported resources, these creatures can scarcely stand up against heavy machine gun fire. Anyway, it's an interesting outing for the troops. I can make out their khaki uniforms crossing back and forth in front of the lights. Looks almost like a real war. There appears to be some slight smoke in the woods bordering the Millstone River. Probably fire started by campers. Well, we ought to see some action soon. One of the companies is deploying on the left flank. A quick thrust and it'll all be over. Now, wait a minute. I see something on top of the cylinder. No, it's nothing but a shadow. Now the troops are on the edge of the Wilmoth Farm. 7,000 armed men closing in on an old metal tube. A tub, rather. Well, wait, that wasn't a shadow. It's something moving. Solid metal, kind of a shield-like affair, rising up out of the cylinder. It's going higher and higher. What? It's standing on legs, actually rearing up on a sort of metal framework. Now it's reaching above the trees, and the searchlights are on it. Hold on.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. The monster is now in control of the middle section of New Jersey and has effectively cut the state through its center. Communication lines are down from Pennsylvania to the Atlantic Ocean. Railroad tracks are torn and service from New York to Philadelphia discontinued, except routing some of the trains through Allerton and Phoenixville. Highways to the north, south, and west are clogged with frantic human traffic. Police and army reserves are unable to control the mad flight. By morning, the fugitives will have swelled Philadelphia, Camden, and Trenton, it is estimated, to twice their normal population. Martial law prevails throughout New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania. At this time, we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there. In the meantime, placing our faith in God, we must continue the performance of our duties, each and every one of us, so that we may confront this destructive adversary with a nation united, courageous, and consecrated to the preservation of human supremacy on this earth. I thank you.
You have just heard the Secretary of the Interior speaking from Washington. Bulletins too numerous to read are piling up in the studio here. We're informed that the central portion of New Jersey is blacked out from radio communication due to the effect of the heat ray upon power lines and electrical equipment. Here is a special bulletin in New York. Cables have been received from English, French, and German scientific bodies offering assistance. Astronomers report continued gas outbursts at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The majority voiced the opinion that the enemy will be reinforced by additional rocket machines. There have been several attempts made to locate Professor Pearson of Princeton, who has observed Martians at close range. It is feared he was lost in the recent battle. Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report three Martian machines visible above treetops, moving north toward Somerville with population fleeing ahead of them. The heat ray is not in use, although advancing at express train speed, invaders pick their way carefully. They seem to be making a conscious effort to avoid destruction of cities and countryside. However, they stop to uproot power lines, bridges, and railroad tracks. Their apparent objective is to crush resistance, paralyze communication, and disorganize human society. Here is a bulletin from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Coon hunters have stumbled on a second cylinder similar to the first, embedded in the great swamp 20 miles south of Morristown. Army field pieces are proceeding before the cylinder can be opened and the fighting machine rigged. They are taking up a position in the foothills of Watchung Mountains. Another bulletin from Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report enemy machines, now three in number, increasing speed northward, kicking over houses and trees in their evident haste to form a conjunction with their allies south of Morristown. Machines also sighted by telephone operator east of Middlesex, within 10 miles of Plainfield. Here's a bulletin from Winston Field, Long Island. A fleet of army bombers carrying heavy explosive flying north in pursuit of enemy. Scouting planes act as guides. They keep the speeding enemy in sight. Just a moment, please, ladies and gentlemen. We've run special wires to the artillery line and adjacent villages to give you direct reports in the zone of the advancing enemy. First, we take you to the battery of the 22nd Field Artillery, located in the Watchung Mountains.
Range 32 meters.
32 meters.
Projection 39 degrees.
39 degrees.
Fire!
140 yards to the right, sir.
Shift range 31 meters.
31 meters.
Projection 37 degrees.
37 degrees.
Fire!
Hit, sir. Got the tripod of one of them. They're stopped. The others are trying to repair it.
Quick, get the range. Shift 50, 30 meters.
30 meters.
Projection 27 degrees.
27 degrees.
Fire!
Can't see the shell answer. Letting off a smoke.
What is it?
Black smoke, sir. Moving this way. Lying close to the ground. Moving fast.
Put on gas masks. Get ready to fire. Shift to 24 meters.
24 meters.
Projection 24 degrees.
24 degrees.
Fire.
I can't see, sir. Smoke's coming nearer.
Get the range.
23 meters.
23 meters.
43 off Bayonne, New Jersey. Lieutenant Bolt, commanding 8 bombers, reporting to Commander Fairfax, Langham Field. This is Bolt reporting to Commander Fairfax, Langham Field. Enemy tripod machines now in sight. Reinforced by 3 machines from the Morristown cylinder. 6 altogether. 1 machine partially crippled. Believed hit by shell from army gun in Watchung Mountains. Guns now appear silent. A heavy black fog hanging close to the earth of extreme density, nature unknown. No sign of heat ray. Enemy now turns east, crossing Passaic River into the Jersey marshes. Another straddles the Pulaski Skyway. Evident objective is New York City. They're pushing down a high-tension power station. The machines are close together now, and we're ready to attack. Plane circling, ready to strike. 1,000 yards and we'll be over the first. ...800 yards. ...600. 400. 200. There they go. The giant arm raised. Green flash. They're spraying us with flame. 2,000 feet. Engines are giving out. No chance to release bombs. Only one thing left. Drop on them, plane and all. We're diving on the first one. Now the engine's gone. This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. Come in, please.
This is Langham Field. Go ahead.
8 Army bombers in engagement with enemy tripod machines over Jersey Flats. Engines incapacitated by heat ray. All crashed. 1 enemy machine destroyed. Enemy now discharging heavy black smoke in direction of...
This is Newark, New Jersey. This is Newark, New Jersey. Warning. Poisonous black smoke pouring in from Jersey marshes. Reaches South Street. Gas masks useless. Urge population to move into open spaces. Automobiles use routes 7, 23, 24. Avoid congested areas. Smoke now spreading over Raymond Boulevard.
Calling 8X3R. Come in, please.
This is 8X3R coming back at 2X2L.
How's reception? How's reception? K, please. Where are you, 8X3R? What's the matter? Where are you?
I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building. I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Estimated in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchinson River Parkway still kept open for motor traffic. Avoid bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army is wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end. People are holding service here below us in the cathedral. Now I look down the harbor, all manner of boats, overloaded with fleeing population, pulling out from docks. Streets are all jammed, noise and crowds like New Year's Eve in city. Wait a minute, the enemy is now in sight above the Palisades. Five great machines. First one is crossing the river. I can see it from here, wading the Hudson like a man wading through a brook. A bulletin is handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis. Seem to be timed and spaced. Now the first machine reaches the shore. He stands watching, looking over the city. Steel cowlish head is even with the skyscrapers. He waits for the others. They rise like a line of new towers on the city's west side. Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke. Drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now.
They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
CQ. 2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ, New York. Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone? 2X2L.
You are listening to a CBS presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air in an original dramatization of The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. The performance will continue after a brief intermission. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, starring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air.
I set down these notes on paper. I'm obsessed by the thought that I may be the last living man on Earth. I've been hiding in this empty house near Grover's Mill, a small island of daylight cut off by the black smoke from the rest of the world. All that happened before the arrival of these monstrous creatures in the world now seems part of another life. A life that has no continuity with the present. Furtive existence of the lonely derelict who pencils these words on the back of some astronomical notes bearing the signature of Richard Pearson. I look down at my blackened hand and I try to connect them with a professor who lives at Princeton and who on the night of October 20th glimpsed through his telescope an orange splash of light on a distant planet. My wife, my colleagues, my students, my books, my observatory, my world. Where are they? Did they ever exist? Am I Richard Pearson? What day is it? Do days exist without calendars? Does time pass when there are no human hands left to wind the clocks? Writing down my daily life, I tell myself I shall preserve human history between the dark covers of this little book that was meant to record the movements of the stars. But to write, I must live, and to live, I must eat. Find moldy bread in the kitchen and an orange not too spoiled to swallow. Keep watch at the window. Time to time, I catch sight of a Martian above the black smoke. Smoke still holds the house in its black coil, but at length there's a hissing sound, and suddenly I see a Martian mounted on his machine, spraying the air with a jet of steam as if to dissipate the smoke. I watch in a corner as his huge metal legs nearly brush against the house. Exhausted by terror, I fall asleep. It's morning. Morning. Sun streams in the window. Black cloud of gas is lifted, and the scorched meadows to the north look as though a black snowstorm had passed over them. I venture from the house. I make my way to a road, no traffic. Here and there, a wrecked car, baggage overturned, a blackened skeleton. Push on north. For some reason, I feel safer trailing these monsters than running away from them. And I keep a careful watch. I've seen the Martians feed. Should one of their machines appear over the top of trees, I'm ready to fling myself flat on the earth. I come to a chestnut tree. October. Chestnuts are ripe. I've got my pockets. I must keep alive. 2 days I wander in a vague northerly direction through a desolate world. Finally, I notice a living creature. A small red squirrel in a beech tree. I stare at him and wonder. He stares back at me. I believe at that moment the animal and I shared the same emotion. The joy of finding another living being. Push on north. I find dead cows in a brackish field and beyond the charred ruins of a dairy in a silo. Main standing guard over the wasteland like a lighthouse. Deserted by the sea. Stride the silo, perches a weathercock. The arrow points north. North. Next day, I come to a city. City vaguely familiar in its contours, yet its buildings strangely dwarfed and leveled off as if a giant had sliced off its highest towers with a capricious sweep of his hand. Reached the outskirts, I found Newark. Newark, undemolished but humbled by some whim of the advancing Martians. Presently, with an odd feeling of being watched, I caught sight of something crouching in a doorway. I made a step towards it, and it rose up and became a man. A man armed with a large knife.
Stop! Where do you come from?
I come from... from many places. A long time ago, from Princeton.
Princeton, huh? That's near Grover's Mill.
Yes.
Grover's Mill. There's no food here. This is my country. All this end of town down the river. There's only food for one. Which way are you going?
I don't know. I guess I'm looking... people.
Hey, what was that? Did you hear something just then?
No. Only a bird. A live bird.
Yeah. You get to know that birds have shadows these days. Say, we're in the open here. Let's crawl in this doorway here and talk.
Have you seen any Martians?
No. They're going over to New York. Night, the sky's alive with their lights, just as if people were still living in it. By daylight, you can't see them. 5 days ago, a couple of them carried something big across the flats from the airport. I think they're learning how to fly.
Fly?
Yeah, fly.
Then it's all over with humanity. Stranger, there's still you and I. Two of us left.
They got themselves in solid. They wrecked the greatest country in the world. Those green stars, they're probably falling somewhere every night. They've only lost one machine. There isn't anything to do. We're done. We're licked.
Where were you? You're in a uniform.
Yeah, what's left of it. I was in the militia. National Guard. That's good. There wasn't any war. Any more than there's war between men and ants.
Yes, but we're eatable ants. I found that out. What'll they do to us?
I thought it all out. Right now, we're caught as we're wanted. A Martian only has to go a few miles to get a crowd on the run. But they won't keep on doing that. They'll begin catching us systematic, like keeping the best and storing us in cages and things. They haven't begun on us yet.
Not begun?
Not begun. All that's happened so far is because we don't have sense enough to keep quiet. Bothering them with guns and such stuff and losing our heads and rushing off in crowds. Now, instead of our... rushing around blind, we got to fix ourselves up according to the way things are now. Cities, nations, civilization, progress.
Yes, but if that's so, what is there to live for?
Well, there won't be any more concerts for a million years or so, and no nice little dinners at restaurants. If it's amusement you're after, I guess the game's up.
What is there left?
Life, that's what. I want to live. Yeah, and so do you. We're not going to be exterminated. And I don't mean to be caught either. Tamed and fattened and bred like an ox.
What are you going to do?
I'm going on. Right under their feet. I got a plan. We men as men, we're finished. We don't know enough. We got to learn plenty before we got a chance. We've got to live and keep free what we learn, see? I've thought it all out, see?
Well, tell me the rest.
Well, it isn't all of us that are made for wild beasts. That's what it got to, that's what it got to be. That's why I watched you. Watched you. All those little office workers that used to live in these houses, they'd be no good. They haven't any stuff in them. They used to run off to work. I've seen hundreds of them running to catch their commuter's train in the morning, afraid they'd get canned if they didn't. Running back at night, afraid they wouldn't be in time for dinner. Lives insured and a little invested in case of accidents. Yeah, and on Sundays, worried about the hereafter. Well, the Martians, they'll be a godsend for those guys. Nice roomy cages, good food, careful breeding, no worries. Yeah, after a week or so of chasing around the fields on empty stomachs, they'll come and be glad to be caught.
You've thought it all out, haven't you?
Sure, you bet I have. That isn't all. These Martians are going to make pets of some of them. Train them to do tricks. Who knows, get sentimental over the pet boy who grew up and had to be killed. Yeah, and some maybe. They'll train to hunt us.
Oh, no, it's impossible. Human.
Yes, beings. They will. There's men who do it gladly. If one of them ever comes after me, by...
In the meantime, you and I and others like us, where are we to live when the Martians own the Earth?
I got it all figured out. We'll live underground. I've been thinking about the sewers. Under New York, there are miles and miles of them. The main ones, they're big enough for anybody. Then there's cellars, vaults, underground storerooms, railway tunnels, subways. You begin to see, huh? We'll get a bunch of strong men together. No weaklings. That rubbish, out.
As you meant me to go.
Well, right. Give you a chance, didn't I?
Won't quarrel about that. Go on.
Well, we got to make safe places for us to stay in, see? Get all the books we can. Science books. That's where men like you come in, see? We raid the museums. We'll even spy on the Martians. May not be so much we have to learn before... Listen. Just imagine this. Four or five of their own fighting machines suddenly start off. Heat rays right and left. Not a Martian in them. Not a Martian in them, see? But men. Men who've learned the way how. May even in our time... Gee, imagine having one of them lovely things with a heat ray wide and free. We'd turn it on Martians. We'd turn it on men. We'd bring everybody down on their knees.
That's your plan.
Yeah. You, me, a few more of us. We'd own the world.
I see.
Hey. Hey, what's the matter? Where are you going?
Not to your world. Bye, stranger. Well, after parting with the artilleryman, I came at last to the Holland Tunnel, entered that silent tube, anxious to know the fate of the great city on the other side of the Hudson. Cautiously, I came out of the tunnel and made my way up Canal Street. Reached 14th Street, and there again were black powder and several bodies and an evil, ominous smell from the gratings of the cellars of some of the houses. I wandered up through the 30s and 40s. Stood alone on Times Square. Caught sight of a lean dog running down 7th Avenue with a piece of dark brown meat in his jaws and a pack of starving mongrels at his heels. Made a wide circle around me as though he feared I might prove a fresh competitor. Walked up Broadway in the direction of that strange powder, past silent shop windows, displaying their mute wares to empty sidewalks. Past the Capitol Theater, silent, dark. Past a shooting gallery where a row of empty guns faced an arrested line of wooden ducks. Near Columbus Circle, I noticed models of 1939 motor cars in the showrooms facing empty streets. Over the top of the General Motors building, I watched a flock of black birds circling in the sky. Hurried on. Suddenly, I caught sight of the hood of a Martian machine, standing somewhere in Central Park, gleaming in the late afternoon sun. An insane idea. I rushed recklessly across Columbus Circle and into the park. I climbed a small hill above the pond at 60th Street, and from there I could see, standing in a silent row along the mall, 19 of those great metal titans, their cowls empty, their steel arms hanging listlessly by their sides. I looked in vain for the monsters that inhabit those machines. Suddenly, my eyes were attracted to the immense flock of black birds that hovered directly below me. They circled to the ground. And there before my eyes, stark and silent, lay the Martians with the hungry birds pecking and tearing brown shreds of flesh from their dead bodies. Later, when their bodies were examined in laboratories, it was found that they were killed by the putrefactive and diseased bacteria against which their systems were unprepared. Slain, after all, man's defenses had failed by the humblest thing that God, his wisdom, has put upon this earth. Before the cylinder fell, there was a general persuasion that through all the deep of space, no life existed beyond the petty surface of our minute sphere. Now we see further. Dim and wonderful is the vision I've conjured up in my mind of life spreading slowly from this little seedbed of the solar system throughout the inanimate vastnesses of sidereal space. But it's a remote dream. Maybe that the destruction of the Martians is only a reprieve to them and not to us. Is the future ordained, perhaps? How strange it now seems to sit in my peaceful study at Princeton, writing down this last chapter of the record, begun at a deserted farm in Grover's Mill. Strange to watch children playing in the streets. Strange to see young people strolling on the green where the new spring grass heals the last black scars of a bruised earth. Strange to watch the sightseers enter the museum where the dissembled parts of a Martian machine are kept on public view. Strange when I recall the time when I first saw it. Bright and clean-cut, hard and silent under the dawn of that last great day.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween. Tonight, the Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations coast to coast has brought you The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, the 17th in its weekly series of dramatic broadcasts featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. Next week, we present a dramatization of three famous short stories. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.